Then?
But it continued for 2 years at Coots, Alberta. Mm-hmm. And there's a field on the American side and a field on the Canadian side. And they landed at the Coots, the American Coots. I don't think they had any buildings on the American side. The Coots were entirely on the Canadian side at the beginning, but they soon had buildings of their own. And they pushed them across the border, which was perfectly legal under law. And then our Canadian troops went there and flew them back all the way. Some of them went from Texas out to the west and through Great Falls and up to Coots. And then they came all the way from Alberta, from Coots, down through Winnipeg and through to Toronto and wherever. Mm-hmm. They didn't all go there, but there were places in Canada where we wanted them to go.
What I'm getting at is that we have a week's delay from September 3rd to September 10th there for Parliament to be recalled, things to get, you know, militia units and things to be mobilized and on ready to
There was no delay whatsoever with us in the Air Force, and I was so very, very busy that I wasn't concerned about what was happening in the Army. That, again, is largely academic. Well, just academic. That's enough. don't put more in the word than
words in your mouth.
Don't put extra thoughts in it. It's just academic.
Okay.
No great depth in academic by itself alone.
What about the British Commonwealth Air Training Plan?
Well, that started on the 26th of September. They arrived in Ottawa then.
So we did. Go through who arrived and what was the circumstances and all that.
Well, they came from Australia, New Zealand, Great Britain, chiefly from Great Britain, Canada. I don't recall if there was anyone there from South Africa at that time. I don't recall. If there were, I've forgotten. So I'm not going to say there weren't. And they commenced the job of hammering out the terms and details of the British Commonwealth Air Training Plan.
Now, who were they, senior Air Force people from all these?
Oh, I'll give you a photograph note with all the addresses. I have a photograph of everyone.
But what types were they? Though they were Air Force officers.
Oh yeah,
it wasn't the political boys. These were the
Air
Force.
Well, we had one or two political.
Mm-hmm.
One or two. But there was an Air Chief Marshal who'd been retired, had gone back by that time, and he came out as the nominal head.
Mm-hmm.
And there was the Secretary of State or something over there as well. I said, well, I'll give you the photograph with all the names.
Okay.
And you later. But now, the guts of the plan, as I told you, were good. Now, I did tell you that the plan had been most carefully thought out by Trench's team. Mackey, Rob, Tedder,
mm-hmm.
Garrod, from 1928 to 1939. None of these officers attended the Ottawa meeting. But they were the brains that had thought it out. The Brits came well armed with all their material ready. We had no material because we had nothing comparable to put in place. Yeah, now the RCF had a strength at that time of about 4,000, all ranks, spread thinly to undertake the work of the two operational commands on the east and west coast, plus the four skeleton training commands located at number one command in Toronto, number two in Winnipeg, three in Montreal, and number four at Regina, and later Calgary. The same command, but the headquarters changed from Regina to Calgary. By 1941-42, the ATP became an astonishing success, despite the fantastic difficulties such as shortage of everything, including aircraft, train personnel, clothing, and all types of equipment. Also, flying in 40 to 50 degree frost in the wintertime, aerodromes deep in snow and mud, followed by gumbo in spring breakup. By 42-43, some 360 training schools were fully operational. They were anything from 1,000 to 1,200 to 2,400 in some of the bigger navigational schools. By that number of schools, I repeat, by 42-43, some 360 training schools were fully operational, and by the end of the war, 131,553 fully trained and highly qualified air crew, including everything right around the sun, navigation, armament, wireless, you name it. Air crew had been dispatched overseas to turn the tide of victory on all battlefronts. The ATC had become the Allies' golden key to victory, in my opinion. I repeat, the golden key. There's the air power. Mm-hmm. Without it, we couldn't Eisenhower couldn't have crossed the channel and his group. Air power laid the way, laid the plan, at least made the plan possible. That without it couldn't be done. There was one pronounced political discourse. It was widely believed the senior personnel with the ATP, that the Mackenzie King government, I don't know, do you want this? It was in before?
Go
ahead. I don't want to do it again.
No, sure.
But the Mackenzie, it was widely believed by senior personnel with the ATP, with the air training plan, that the Mackenzie King government had stipulated at the founding conference in 1939 that United Kingdom British troops coming into Canada for training must not be in units larger than a battalion or an air station of 1,000 to 1,200, and must not be commanded by a British officer of higher rank than colonel or group captain. I told you this. The United Kingdom representatives gasped when they were told this, and later agreed on the basis that comparable conditions would prevail in Great Britain when the trained air crew arrived in the United Kingdom and in the battlefront. Croyle and his only RCAF aide, Group Captain Stedman, attending the conference, made no recorded dissent, but were the UK, both were UK-born, as I told you, and obviously had become a part of the old boys' school tie team. They had. They didn't see anything. They weren't trained staff officers in the higher level anyway. Croyle was never.
Yeah.
He had no earlier staff experience other than the commanding of the station, until he suddenly jumped to sit on the headquarters in Ottawa and be a nice little boy and not cause any ripples in the water.
Now, were you at the concert?
No. Well, I was feeding him, but I didn't sit in, no.
Okay.
Redner was not invited in attendance. Was not invited to be in attendance. He had not been invited to attend at all. And as a fully trained operational staff officer, and his wide operational experience in War One, he never would have agreed to the conditions that Mackenzie King laid down. It was fatal from both sides, particularly for our air crew going into the United Kingdom. As mentioned in Paris earlier, these conditions were primarily responsible for the extensive personnel difficulties in the United Kingdom between the RCF and the RAF from 1942 to the end of the war. No comment with regard to politics and political politicians in war, except to say that Chubby Power, I want this very clear, Chubby Power, who became our boss after the then minister was killed in an aircraft accident, Chubby Power never, to my knowledge, played politics. As you will know, he did not become Minister of Air until the summer of 40. Also, Chubby and Chubby Power and Bredner were invaluable in the building of the training plan, and both were very good friends. Now, that is not the case with the other senior officers there, Chubby Power. Well, he didn't have too much use for the summer. I'll say that he called one a schoolmaster. He called the other one something else again, but he let them go pretty quickly. They didn't last long around in headquarters when Kelly Power took over. Neither one. Well, now.
Now, your particular action during this time is your director of training for the RCF and 38th Wing Commander.
And 39.
And 39.
And up to February 40.
up to February 40. You're promoted to group captain. I guess with the increase in numbers.
I guess not only that, but it's
and overlooked, for sure. I'm not trying to imply that that was the only reason.
I'm sure that I wasn't jumping much over anyway.
Okay.
My promotion was not a jump there, in any case.
I didn't try to imply a jump there.
Well.
So that is important, though. You were very senior.
In years in service, I had a fair seniority, 1916 on. And 1916 to 1932, a few years' service, you see, including the staff college and the various staff appointments.
Promotion was long overdue.
Yeah, well, I wouldn't say that. It was right across Canada.
Yeah.
All the way, right from the top to the bottom, and especially in the airport. We were the last. Our counterparts that we had to deal with in the United Kingdom at least one to two ranks above us all the time, and the same age and the same experience. So, maybe there's some disadvantage in the thing for your suffer, but we didn't worry about it.
Fair enough. Now, in February 40, you do what, sir?
Well, I first had a trip to the United Kingdom, and the Western Front. Well, it allowed us to see things as they were.
So would it now be reporting to whom?
Reporting to back to our own government and our own headquarters in Canada.
So you sort of went out and as an observer? What was your actual job description, if you will?
Called them, like, chiefly to see a look-see at the exact situation. You were going around your troops before a battle, or just as the battles were starting. You looked at everything. The training of the troops, the type of troops they had, their conditions, their armament. Our job was to look, see, and report accordingly.
Now, you stayed in England how long?
We were over about 6 weeks, 2 months.
What was the Blitz going at this point?
No. The Blitz didn't start until after Dunkirk. We were actually in the front line in, about 2 weeks.
Would it be before the fall of France?
Oh, yes. We went through Paris, both ways, and then went right up to our own troops, see our troops in the field. And my first job was to get hold of I wanted a Spitfire, but I couldn't get one. I got a Hurricane. And fly over the German lines and have a look-see what they're doing. And by the spring of 1940, they were beginning a fair build-up in
you
front of...
It's called the Pony War during the
period. Yeah, they're hanging their clothes on the Siegfried line or something or other. Yes, it was that, but it wasn't the Pony War about 2 weeks later, in 1940.
Now you, commandeered a...
Well, I didn't comment. No. I asked one of my good friends of the staff college with me, who was in command, to let me have one. Well, he let me have one, but he didn't want to do it in writing or anything of that kind, nor be held responsible in case I went missing. Because he said, you probably want to go to Berlin. And I said, no, if I even get to Cologne, I'll be lucky because I flew there in World War I. And he said, you can't go to Cologne. But I didn't go to Cologne, but I did have a good look at the German buildup.
What type of appreciation did you develop from this data?
Well, they were ready. They were obviously, they built up for the great push through France, which started 2 weeks after we left. It was obvious to so as soon as I got back and landed on the field, his first words were, don't tell me about it, you're going to tell me all about that buildup. We know all about it. I said, my God, did they know about it in London? They didn't tell me anything about it at the airmen. And you remember the Churchill had been to take over. Churchill hadn't taken over.
Mm-hmm.
And Mr. Umbrella was still sound asleep. And the bits were very well aware of what was coming, the airport. But he said, what can we do? Mr. Umbrella was still the prime minister for Chamberlain. So they
misunderstood. He was trying to build up.
Oh, well, no. The people in the field out there were just as smart as the whip. They knew that they pay no attention to our report.
So What about the air ministry in London at this point? Where was it? Who was in charge?
Oh, well, the air ministry were well on top of the dock, and they were sleeping right in their office. Oh, yes, right around the clock. They slept right on the dock in their office. The beds were in there and everything else. So the air ministry was wide awake, and I'm sure that the admiralty, Churchill had taken over the admiralty by that time, and the admiralty was certainly doing great things.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the armed forces were pretty alert and doing whatever they could do. But what could they do? They had damn little to work with. Very little. After all, MacDonald had been in there since 1929. MacDonald was there.
Mm-hmm.
And then the next, Mr. Pike, the one that had the trouble with the then Prince of Wales, Baldwin. He was so busy Baldwin. Baldwin was first. Baldwin was the first one, and after MacDonald. And he was so busy saving the crown and the British Empire and the government that the armed forces were largely neglected.
Yeah.
Cameron came along with Mr. Umbrella, and he didn't know a damn thing about it. So, let's give the British forces a lot of credit for the work that they did under the conditions they were working under. And even sending the group out to Canada to put on this British Commonwealth Air Training Camp. We couldn't have put that into effect by ourselves alone. The rain came from somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
Offensive machines. And they...
Did you feel pressured and Cheddar and these people when you were in London during this period?
No. Trenchard has retired. About 8 or 10 years or so. But I saw him again in Canada. He came out to during the training time, and I saw him in Canada.
Okay,
so
what about Cheddar? He was...
Cheddar had gone to...
He'd be getting some pretty rarefied
at
this point, wouldn't
he? They were all over the world. No, not too rarefied. He went on... He became the Mounties chief in North Africa. And then he went from that to be the brains with Eisenhower.
Mm-hmm.
All of the good work that Eisenhower was doing, he was number two to Eisenhower.
What about, Lay Mallory was his name?
Well, he...
And Harris.
They were... Yes, I knew them. We called it the Flying Corps, the Air Force Headquarters, the Air Defense Brigade of Great Britain.
Where was that located?
Well, there's...
Is that a Whitehall there? Was that by Admiralty, or what?
Oh, way out in the country. Way out in the country, in the small village itself, and all underground. By 1930, they built part of it, right underground. By 1930.
So they went down in Whitehall with the...
The headquarters are still in London. The man in the field... We commanded
Dowding and Park?
Dowding and Park were in charge of the fighters, the defense of Great
Britain.
Yeah, the defense of Great Britain. Now, the bomber command wasn't Harris at that time, but he took over later. But the command stayed largely the same, except it adapted to its job at the time. But the fighters were the fighter command was the first one involved in the war. There were no great bomber force to send to Europe until later in the war.
What about the Canadian Air Force there? Were they just purely put into RAF units?
Well, no. There were one or two squadrons in France at that time. And when the push came through, they were badly mauled, and they were not well led. Poorly led.
Canadians or
Brits? They were squadron metal. They were led with their own troops, but they were the groups and so on. But even the chief of the whole British Air Force, Ugly Barrett, his nickname was Ugly, he just vamoosed. He faded. He never became anything else in the war. He was a...
What about Bishop and people like these, were they hauled out to...
Well, by that time, they were coming back into the war, and Bishop's large role, which he did very well. He had no training in between World War I and World War II.
How was he drinking at that point?
Well, it was well under control. Well, I've seen him consume great quantities of gin. And on one occasion, he came to Western Command, came out to, in spur in recruiting, I think. He spoke at a meeting in Regina. I went down to be there. And I, it was hot in the summer. And we were wearing a summer uniform. But one of the prominent citizens in Regina put on a pre-luncheon soccer party, whatever you want to call it, just a quick drink. And I remember having a good gin and tonic, and that was all I wanted. The bishop had one, and the host gave him a second one, and I said, I'm really self my glass, I didn't want any more. Bishop said, may I help myself? And he went over, and after about the second or third, he was pouring himself about a half a glass in each gin, and then very little ice, and not very much else in it. And when he used to be the speaker, I was absolutely astonished. He took in, when he went in, he filled it up again, so he had a fair amount of gin. Now, he made an excellent address. He spoke well, very well. Mm-hmm. I was absolutely amazed at his ability to, but he had a fair tummy on him by that time, so he had a place to put it. But my God, when he got back up to the, after the meeting was over, he took off his tunic, and he was absolutely wringing wet. You couldn't see it when he was standing up. It was under his arm. So while he had taken all that gin aboard, he was carrying it. The brain was working. No question about that. No staggering, no worry from that point of view. Don't get me wrong. He carried it beautifully. If there is such a thing as carrying it well. He carried it well. But my God, he was taking a lot of... He died very young. Very, very, very young. About 25 years ago. At least 25 years ago. And he wasn't that old. He was... he must have died around before the 60s.
What about... we're tailing off towards the end. I'm thinking of other personalities that were brought out to the PR work of the Air Force. I'm thinking that Bishop
did an excellent job in recruiting. And his example, undoubtedly, was good. Except, I don't suppose any. If I hadn't been in close attendance there that day at the luncheon, I wouldn't have seen the quantity of gin that he was able to handle. It was good gin. The very best gin. And but he handled it well, but it did not do his health any good in the long run. Well, is it too long?
Yeah, I think we'll pull the plug on it today, and see you next time. Probably pick up in 1940. And get into the actual mechanics of the Commonwealth training plan itself, and you're promoted to Air Commodore and command of number 4.
I think you did cover the mud at York.
Yeah, I looked at the pictures, but I haven't talked about York and or the building of it and those types of things. I hope we can get all that next time. Yeah. That's okay for that. Thank you very much, Air Marshal.
You'll have to go back then. Backtrack
a bit, but that's okay.
Okay.
We'll pick up in 40. Mm-hmm. Thank you, sir. My name is Chris Main, M-A-I-N. I'm with Air Vice Marshal G.R. Hausam, H-O-W-S-A-M. Everybody's Michael Hausen has the CD and the MC, along with numerous other foreign decorations. And the date today is 12 September 1979, and we're at Everybody's Michael Hausen's home in Victoria. And last Easter, we got about as far as 1940. And you going to Regina to be the senior air staff officer for number 4 training command. I was wondering if you go into the circumstances around that. And
Yes. I think on the last day, as you say, we got as far as Regina. and that would be in early, late April or early March, probably in March, I have some memory, around March, 1940. I just returned from the United Kingdom and from France. A couple of weeks before the German blitz base toward Dunkirk. Mm-hmm. They finished in Dunkirk. But when we were there, in the winter, we saw the British Army and the British Air Forces all the way in Northern Europe, along the line. We did the whole front. And I had the, I think as I told you, I had the privilege of flying over the German lines in British fighters. And my great astonishment, I saw the fantastic build-up that was made by the Germans in preparatory to the spring offensive that took place in September 2, the entrance to
the
Turkey.
You said that the person that you were talking to about it there, you said that you told him?
Well, I don't want to go too deeply into that because he was a personal friend.
Mm-hmm.
And when I got back, I was all ready to tell him all about it. And he said, well, it's all right. Canada. We know all about it. We've told them about a dozen times, but Mr. Chamberlain, Mr. Umbrella, and his troops just don't believe it.
Mm-hmm.
Or would that affect. However, since he was a friend of mine, and he's probably still alive, I don't want to get him into any trouble.
Okay. You get back to Canada, and you're sent to Regina.
That is the headquarters of number 4 training command under the British Commonwealth Air Training Command. And my position was the senior air staff officer in charge of organization and training. So
you'd be
Richard
Bell, and the clock has stopped dinging. So you get yourself to Regina, so your duties are pretty all inclusive there.
Well, the senior air staff officer at that time, they had no air. We had an air officer command who came later. He came about 6 months or 6 weeks later. But later on, in our organization, the command organization, we brought in not only the AOC, the air officer commanding, but his deputy was senior. Senior minister officer, but he was an air commodore, but he was a deputy to the AOC. So the air vice marshal became what he had been all the way along by that time, an air vice marshal. But the new position came out for the senior air staff officer, and in the original, he was completely in charge of organization and training. And
now, your training...
There were a number of stations operational by that time. There were a few right from the 1940s, from the day that the autumn of 39,
mm-hmm.
we set up some of the schools immediately. But there were a number of schools, all great stations,
mm-hmm.
up to 1,400 men, and the complement of aircraft and pupils.
Would he be flying Harvard
today? No, Harvard didn't come in until considerably later, in 1942, as I recall. There may have been a few Harvards at the training schools, in Ontario.
Mm-hmm.
They were very very few in Western Canada until about 1942, early 42. But at that time, a particular job was to go out into the field, find a suitable location for training schools, Moose Jaw and Mossbank and Yorkton and Saskatchewan and Saskatoon and a hundred other places where crossing from Lethbridge, Medicine Hat, and Fifth Current, in all the way right up to the Rockies, and then north to High River and Calgary and ten holes. Those aerodromes had already been in use in a smaller way. We had to enlarge them and improve on them and rebuild on them to meet the requirements of today. Now, in addition to all of that, we had to find new fields, many new fields that had not been used at all, and build them into stations all throughout the whole canal. The whole thing went on simultaneously.
What were you using for a training scheme, if you will? You had things all written down and decided how many hours it took to get it
back. That would be very, very carefully worked out long before the war broke out.
Were you by Trenchard
and his crew, or was it just mainly? Well, Trenchard and his team, as we called it, had been the key of it, but it had been greatly polished, continuously polished by the training facilities in the United Kingdom. They passed it down to us, and we again adapted it and modified it to meet our Canadian conditions, winter conditions, which this didn't have a thing to do with. Their winter is so completely different to ours, it's almost negative.
So the whole nuts and bolts of the operation was figured out beforehand.
Well, you had the nuts and bolts had been figured, estimated very, very carefully. There's no question about that, and that is the genius of the town. The staff, that part of the staff work had been done in the United Kingdom before it got to town. Now, we had to readapt that to our work, or to our situation, largely to the weather. But it'll be a quick idea on the whole thing. Your crews, your air crews, when you were finished, you had pilots, navigators, armament, wireless operators, a dozen others. And the whole of those people, they went into a mill. It took longer to build certain types, to train certain types than others. Considerably long. So the numbers going in, into each had to go through the mill, but the combined mills had to produce all of these things in an orderly way to produce the team for each aircraft, type of aircraft, bomber and so on. So we had to have so many pilots coming off the line, so many navigators coming off the line, so many army people, the whole lot. If you had a great buildup of, say, navigators and no pilots, if you had a buildup of anyone, you'd be cutting up your shelves or cutting up your accommodation and no work for them. So the machine had to operate very, very carefully. That had been most carefully considered in the United Kingdom. All we had to do is readapt it to our Canadian situation in putting them in so they came out properly. It is a most meticulous job, unbelievable. The world were sure that we would break down and fold up and give in. Well, we didn't fold up and we didn't give in. It worked beautifully. Well, it worked very well.
So if I got this correct, then you weren't having to spend your time developing the program as much as implementing the program. Is that correct?
Well, the plan was definitely developed, if you like, as we went along. As we found we could improve on it, it could be adapted. It was something that could be adapted. It had to be adapted. It had to be readjusted all the way, carefully, because these things never do work out exactly the way we come off the drawing board. You've got to find out from trial and error and be sharp enough to rectify the plan as necessary. It had to be readapted, especially for cold weather flying.
Now, were there any great demands, say, in 40, like we need more pilots, or we need more navigators, or we need more wireless operators? Well, there are many great demands coming to you in that sense, other than in the planned schedule itself.
Well, for example, after the fall of France, Churchill demanded that the plan be doubled overnight. Canada doubled it overnight, practically doubled it overnight, and that made a completely new job of work. And then...
Well, you times everything by two? Is that what the idea is?
Well, not quite. You had to use your judgment. And also, you could only do what you could force your troops to work to. About 18 hours a day and 18 hours a day and 30 days a month and 365 days in a year, and there you are. How much more can you do? And most of them were working full out all the way.
What about the comparison, sir, between your training, if you will, for the first war?
Oh,
and,
there was never any comparable urgency. We had no comparable urgency to the War II.
You didn't have to turn them out as quickly? Is that what you mean? Or?
Well, furthermore, more importantly, they just didn't bother. You got much of your training right on the spot and fighting.
What, in the first one?
Yeah. But we our losses were unbelievable in War One. Whereas we decided under no way would this ever happen again. Our losses were during training were high enough, but nothing comparable to War One.
Mm-hmm. Now, you're an administrative officer in this particular point. You're a group captain, and you're an administrative officer.
No, the word administrative is wrong. It's operational all the way.
Operational.
Oh yeah.
So you'd be dealing basically with the training.
That is my basic job. But as the acting as the temporary second in command, I had to again make sure that the administrative arrangement fitted the training, or your training doesn't go forward.
Mm.
You can't have operational work functioning properly unless the administration fits. There must be complete cooperation and complete integration, whatever you want to call it. So you actually, in my own case, what I did, I continued with my operations by day, operational work and organization and operation, and we held a night session every night, an evening and a night session every night, combined with the administrators to help them get them into the picture and keep them in the picture day by day.
Now, you remain with us until 1941.
Yes.
And then you make the jump to commanding a particular...
I asked for it again and again. I'd been on staff work, largely headquarters staff work, which enabled me to get in some flying. But I'd been on it, for the past 10 years, I had about 2.5 years out of it. So there was much too much staff and much too little blue water or blue sky or whatever you want to call it. And I'd asked for it over and over again, and I demanded it to the fullest possible extent that you dare demand. And I finally got it to build a school at Yorkton.
Now,
with the troops, you're right in command, right in the mud, you're right down the fire.
Well, you're in the mud at Yorkton, that's for sure.
Well, we cured the mud problem.
What about, the circumstances around you're given command of Yorkton.
Yes.
You got this muddy field.
Well, it'd be a perfectly good wheat field. You're going to crop of wheat the year before, a great crop of wheat. But the difference between building runways in the autumn and in the winter and building all the buildings, tarmac or whatever you want, in the winter or in the spring, so much of it had to be continued after we started operation. Normally it would never happen. You'd never mix the two. You'd get your house completed before you moved in. But this it was a business of moving in when it was about half done. And you had your troops, and then all the work were building all under in the same area.
How big an establishment was Yorkton when you joined?
It was just a very small holding crew, but very shortly we had about 1,000 men, 1,200 men.
So you had to become a contractor as well as...
Not contracting. We just took over our own sections of the work, and the regardless of what the... There are many things we could do, and anything we could do ourselves, we just got busy to make our work operational. We weren't concerned about anything we could leave. We left that for the contractor. But things that had to be done to enable us to get on with the operations, and if we could do it ourselves, we did it. We could use a shovel and an axe and a hammer and saw or whatever it had to. We could do it if we could do it. And most of our troops were tremendously handy, far better than the contractors.
Wasn't there difficulty with the contractor? His work was not up to snuff?
Well, not that much. There was a little difficulty later on with the deep sewers, and that was quite understandable. The sewers, for example, in Saskatchewan, it astonished me to find that it was necessary to bury the deep water pipes and everything else so deeply, around about 10 or 12 feet is a minimum. That's a long way down in the ground. Now, here in Victoria, they only laid about a foot under the ground, a foot or 18 inches, whatever, but nothing, practically nothing. Whereas you go down to 8 or 10 or 12 feet with the sewage and the water pipes and the whole engineering, it becomes a major task of work and a pretty expensive one. Now, that was the contractor's job, not mine. Well, some of it wasn't as well done as it might have been, and some of it didn't work as well as it should, but we'd photographed it going down, and much to the consternation of the contractor, and as soon as he was shown some of the photographs of his work, when the board came to sit on it, he immediately got busy and rectified it. So it was never a problem. We cured it before it became a problem.
I just thought I'd tape on this side. Let me just flip over the tape.